Hello and welcome to The Progress Theory, where we discuss scientific principles for optimizing human performance. I am Dr. Phil Price, and on today's episode, we're joined by UK astronaut, Dr. Megan Christian. So recently, the European Space Agency held a selection process to select the next batch of European astronauts, and three of them came from the UK, one of them being Dr. Megan Christian. So I wanted to know a little bit more about what her prerequisites were, which helped her selection process, what the selection process was like, and does she have any recommendations for anyone that wishes to be an astronaut someday? As always, follow The Progress Theory on Instagram and YouTube. Check out all of our other content. Here is Dr. Megan Christian. Are you a hybrid athlete who wants to learn more about how to combine your strength and endurance training? Well, I've written a new book, The Science of Hybrid Training. In this book, I provide insight into the misconceptions surrounding strength and endurance training by distilling the past 50 years of research and drawing on the conversations I had with great scientists, coaches, and athletes on the Progress Theory podcast. This book is essential reading for hybrid athletes and coaches who are looking to understand the key training variables and their effect on the simultaneous development of strength and endurance performance. Get your copy now, available to buy from Amazon. Now, let's get into the show. Megan, how are we? Thank you for coming on to The Progress Theory.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Yeah, I've been really excited for this because obviously I know you went through the European Space Agency astronaut selection process, and I was doing some data collection with our research team regarding exercise countermeasures at the time, and we had a number of people come as be participants who were also applying. I nearly applied myself and never have got through. But so that means, you know, speaking to someone that did, I'm just like really keen to know a bit more about you and what your plans for the future are.
It was probably, well, definitely, I would say, a kind of life-changing thing to do, to go through that whole selections process. I didn't expect that I would get through, but somehow made it to the end. And yeah, I certainly went through all the various medical tests that they had us do.
Yeah. Well, before we go into a little bit more detail with that, do you want to explain a little bit who you are and your background?
Yeah, sure. So my full name's Megan Christian. I was born in the UK, but grew up in Australia. I did a Bachelor of Engineering in Industrial Chemistry, and I did get the chance to do a couple of sort of industrial training placements during that time with a particular scholarship that I had. And I'm one of those people that kind of changed my mind every day about what it was I wanted to do with my life. So I thought those industrial training placements would be quite useful to help me decide. And I did enjoy them, but I think that's kind of the problem. I kind of enjoy everything. So I actually ended up not going into industry, and I did a PhD, and I worked on nanomaterials for hydrogen storage. And then after that, I wanted some international experience. So I found a postdoc at the National Research Council of Italy in Bologna on a material called graphene. So working across a whole range of different applications, still kind of keeping the theme of alternative energy in a way. There, I also had the chance to spend a year in Antarctica doing climate change research. And it was while I was in Antarctica that I decided I wanted to apply to become an astronaut. And then after that, after somehow being selected, I decided I wanted to be more in the space sector while I wait the possibility of a mission in the future, hopefully. So I then moved over back to the UK, working at the UK Space Agency in the exploration team.
That is such a cool history of events. I mean, yeah, I'm particularly jealous of your time in Antarctica. What was that like?
It was an incredible experience. I mean, it just felt so special to be there because, you know, there aren't that many people that actually get to go. I sort of think back to when I went to the International Antarctic Centre when I was a kid. It's a really cool museum in Christchurch in New Zealand. And I have always been fascinated by Antarctica since then. And so I thought, you know, maybe one day I'll make a lot of money and I'll get to go on a cruise to Antarctica. Well, making the money hasn't happened, but I did get to go to Antarctica. And actually, the first time that I got this email from the National Research Council about it, they sent it out to all employees asking who wants to go and spend a year there because they have permanent observatories there. I thought back to that museum and I thought, oh, that would be amazing. But I didn't think that they would accept somebody with my background. I was a material scientist, really sort of applied sciences, whereas they were looking for somebody to do atmospheric physics and meteorology. I knew what meteorology was, didn't know a lot about atmospheric physics. So I actually sort of thought, yeah, that they wouldn't accept me. So I ignored it. But then a year later, I got the same email again. I thought, oh, you know what? I'm just going to reply and see if they'd accept an application from someone like me. They said, yeah, come and have a chat. Turned out that chat was an interview and I was accepted to go and spend the year there. It was tough, definitely, because of the physical conditions. You know, we got down to minus 104 degrees Celsius. I was working outside every day. That was wind chill, by the way. Without wind, it was minus 80, but that's still very cold. And also the fact that the sun didn't rise for 100 days during that time. So we were in constant darkness. We were stuck with this small crew for 9 months of the year. Really had to fend for ourselves if anything went wrong, because there was no way for anybody to come in or out. But the hardest part is actually the psychological challenge, which comes from all those physical factors put together. But it is kind of the hardest thing to work through, you know, making sure you keep up team morale and making sure that you get along with everybody and that you don't get too lonely, missing home too much. And also that you don't get bored, because yes, there was a lot of work to do, but there was also a lot of free time that not the kind of activities that you could do when you're in kind of the normal world. So that means that you have a lot of time that you have to come up with ways of filling.
Yeah, I can't imagine you thinking, oh, I've got some free time, I'll go for a run here, and realize it's minus 80 outside. That's a bit limited.
Yeah, well, actually, some people do. So it's,
oh,
yes, yeah, so really? Some people have done some serious running in the middle of winter at Concordia Station. I don't think I'm up for that. I mean, it's just too cold. But there are some people that do, in their free time, go out for a run in minus 80 degrees, and they just wear lots and lots of layers. During the summer season, we've had people do marathons outside, so not just on the treadmill, but actually outside around the base. So it's doable, but they're pretty impressive people that manage to do that.
Does the timing darkness coincide with the very low temperatures as well? So like you said, there was, what did you say, about 80 days where there was no, wow, so it's freezing and just dark. That must be really tough.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So the summer season, where you have a lot more people on the base, you have up to sort of 90-ish people, that goes from November to January. And then after that, everybody else leaves and you just have the winter of a crew of about 13 people, and it starts to get colder. So the summer season, the average temperature is about minus 30. It actually feels quite nice. You can spend hours outside in those conditions. As long as you're wearing the right kind of clothing, you can spend hours outside working. But during the winter, the average temperature is closer to minus 60, minus 70, and then you add wind chill to that. And so you really can't spend a lot of time outside. You have to, because that's where you're working, but you can't spend more than, if it's really cold, sort of 20 minutes outside before going into one of the shelters and warming up and then going out again.
How did you find moving from material science to atmospheric and meteorology?
I was quite worried about it before I went. I thought that there were skills that I wouldn't necessarily be able to develop in the time that I needed to. In terms of the academic aspect, that was okay, because the experiments have been designed and implemented by PIs back in Europe. And so they're really the brains behind it. And those of us that are there for the winter, we're the technicians that are implementing the experiment. You don't have to have a university degree in that subject to be able to run the experiments. Any understanding that you have certainly helps, but really you need the technical skills. I found that having operated a lot of scientific instruments for my own research in the past, I was able to kind of transfer that over to the atmospheric physics and meteorology experiments. And also, I really enjoyed that learning curve. So again, like I said, I was worried at the beginning before I went, particularly for some of the electronics and computer programming aspects that I would have to deal with, because I hadn't done a lot of it before. And I was worried that I wasn't going to be able to do that. But then I got there and I had 2 weeks of handover with the winter of a crew from before me, and learned it all in that time, well, as much as I could, and then relied on my companions of that winter over to help me out if there was anything that I was still missing. But I loved it. I loved having that really frenetic time of trying to get on top of all the different techniques I'd have to use.
What form of your trip do you feel that was the skill that has really helped you since leaving Antarctica? Especially because you transitioned to going through the astronaut selection process. What about that stage, about that development time, do you think helped you most when it came to astronaut selection?
it really gives you an opportunity to reflect on your own reactions and emotions and how you deal with difficulties, because you are in that extreme environment. And so your mind and body are both pushed to the absolute limits. And so that allows you to see how you would work in particular situations. And so whether that's good or bad, so, you know, you see that perhaps you didn't have the limits that you thought you did, but at the same time you say, oh, I was a bit more irritable than I thought I was going to be if, you know, somebody didn't put the dishes away or something like that. So it really allowed me to reflect on how I react to things, and I learned when I should confront an issue or when I should just let it slide. And so I think it was probably the relationship side of things that I learned most about. And, you know, being able to be both a leader and a follower, really knowing how to communicate and work in a team. And they're definitely some of the skills that the European Space Agency was looking for.
Now, that's really cool to hear, because, I mean, the first thing you think about probably is like technical skills, or, you know, what kind of skills that you have when it comes to astronaut selection. But I guess your ability to persevere through difficult times and your ability to work well with individuals provides the foundation for you to use those technical skills, doesn't it?
Yeah. So I mean, the first thing that the space agency looks for are those technical skills. That's kind of the first barrier that you have to overcome. They basically have that with a set of minimum requirements. So you have to have at least a master's degree in some kind of science, engineering, or medicine, or you can be a test pilot and have 3 years of professional experience on top of that. And so once you've got that, then it's everything else that builds on top of that that they're looking for, because, you know, there are quite a lot of people out there that have that minimum requirement. And in fact, 22,500 people applied. And I think most of those applications were valid from that perspective. It really is those extra things that they were looking for. And they clearly valued the experience that I had at Concordia, and not just the experience that I had, but also that others had had, because one of the other people who was selected as a member of the reserve from Austria had done a year at Concordia the year before me. So I think this kind of the experience in extreme environments and the teamwork and the way that develops you as a person definitely helped.
Mm. Would you go back and do another year at Concordia?
I did go back, but I just went back for a couple of months. Would I do a whole year again? I think I would need to find a new way of challenging myself, because like I said, there is that kind of boredom aspect that does come into it, because you are doing the same repetitive things over and over. So perhaps if I was in a different role, if I was in a different base, I would absolutely love to go back to Antarctica, but not doing exactly the same thing as I did last time.
Mm. Would you want to climb Mount Vinson?
Huh, interesting question. So I haven't got a lot of experience in mountain climbing. I'm not high mountain climbing anyway. I do a lot of hiking and BFRRs at kind of low altitudes, but it is definitely something that I would love to do. So yeah, why not?
Now, I noticed that I think there was a page on the European Space Agency website, and it listed a few things that you were very keen on. One was scuba diving, and it sounded like a lot of your hobbies are very outdoor. And I know that one of the things, if I went to Antarctica, I'd love to climb Mount Vincent. So I was like, okay, would you like to climb Mount Vincent? And Vincent, I keep saying Vincent, but yeah, that's definitely a bucket list thing.
Yeah, no, I absolutely. I mean, it's not something that I've necessarily thought about before, but like you say, I love the outdoors, and that kind of started from when I was a kid, and our family holiday was usually to go whitewater rafting, or at Christmas time we would always go camping and do a lot of outdoor activities while we were there. And then while I lived in Italy, I mentioned Via Ferrata. It's a kind of alpine climbing cross between hiking and rock climbing. I loved to do that. So if I can get outdoors, I will.
For your astronaut selection process, what was the key thing that made you think, you know what, I'm going to go for this?
So I decided that I wanted to apply when I was in Antarctica. And there were a number of reasons for that. One of them is what I was talking about before, the way that it built my confidence. Because like I said, before I went, I didn't necessarily think that I would have the skills that I would need. But then I got there and I really loved it. I loved building those skills, and I discovered that I actually could. That was a huge contributing factor. Also, I really enjoyed being the custodian of other people's experiments. So people had put their life's work into designing these experiments, these important experiments on climate change, but they couldn't be there to be the hands to implement the experiments themselves. And I was there and had that privilege. And that's what astronauts do up on the International Space Station. That combined with the fact that you're doing it in an extreme environment, that was just really inspiring for me. And it seemed like the next logical step was to try and do it in another more extreme environment of space. And at the same time as that, I was also just being inspired by the landscape and particularly the starscape. There was one task that I had to do frequently once a week with a colleague of mine. I would have to walk out to this tower about a kilometer away from the base and then dig up the snow so we could get our harnesses on and then climb up this 45-meter tower, clean all the instruments, the meteorological instruments that were on board, and then come back down and go back to the base. At Concordia Station, we're at high altitude. So that's another one of these physical difficulties. We have low oxygen levels. It's like being at about 4,000 meters at our latitudes. It's because the air is thinner at the poles. It's actually at an altitude of 3,233 meters. Yeah. But these things combined, so the fact that it's at high altitude, which means you have this thinner atmosphere, you have low atmospheric pollution, low light pollution, and we're doing this walk out to the tower, which takes about 20 minutes. And we would just take our headlamps off and let our eyes adjust to the darkness and look up at the stars. And felt absolutely blanketed by them. I felt like we were really inside them. And in fact, if it was a moonless day, because remember, this is 100 days of darkness, we could actually see our shadow in the light of the Milky Way. That's how bright those stars are.
Wow.
And so this inspiring environment combined with the things that I was doing led me to think, oh, yeah, this is my path. This is what I want to do with my life.
Wow, that must have been an amazing experience. Probably the best view I've got of the stars was climbing Mount Kilimanjaro. And, you know, the lack of light pollution up there, the view is just absolutely incredible. So, but that's still going to have some level of light pollution. I'm assuming nowhere near like in, or, you know, Antarctica is going to have very minimal light pollution. That must have been absolutely incredible.
I mean, there is some light pollution because we have the base there and we have the various shelters that are around, but it's nothing like being anywhere near a city. So yeah, it's really special. And another place that I've had a really good view of the stars was in the outback of Australia. So in the Northern Territory, I went on this safari and one of the nights we were camping out on an abandoned runway and I just put my bedroll out, didn't bother to go in the tent. And so I could just fall asleep looking at the stars. And again, that just the amount that you could see was incredible.
I like the reason that you went for astronaut selection is a combination of wanting to push yourself and develop, but also because you wanted to really appreciate the experiences that you know you're going to get because you had a taste of them on Antarctica.
Yeah, that's right. That's a really good way of summarizing it.
I'm going to interrupt here because I wanted to share with you the Progress Theory newsletter. If you want the latest information and recommendations on how to optimize your physical and mental performance, then subscribe to the free Progress Theory newsletter on Substack today. Click the link in the show notes and subscribe to get the best information on human performance sent straight to your email. Now, back to the podcast. Explain the selection to me. What happens initially? Because there's a long form you needed to put in. And then what happens next? What kind of information are they looking for? And then how do people get whittled down to the people that were selected at the end?
Yeah, so first of all, it is kind of like any other job application where you send in a CV and motivation letter, but there are two extra things. And one of them is this form that you have to fill in that you mentioned. And that's a questionnaire that asks you things like whether you have any additional degrees, additional languages, whether you have had expedition experiences for at least 6 weeks in an extreme environment, whether you've worked in a lab, whether you have a scuba diving license, whether you have any flight experience. So just building up a picture of the experiences you've had in your life and any extra technical skills that you might have. And the second extra thing that you had to upload was a preliminary medical certificate, the kind of medical that you need to have if you're going for a private pilot license, for example. So that was the first stage. you uploaded all of those things. And like I said, at that point, there were 22,500 people that did that. This was the hardest stage to get through because they brought that down to 1,400 people who were invited to DLR in Hamburg to do the computer-based testing. And this computer-based testing is kind of along the lines of what you have to do to become a pilot on a commercial airliner. So there are things like there are tests on maths and physics, also English, easy for those of us who are lucky enough to be native English speakers. But then there are things like memory tests, spatial awareness, logic, and yeah, I guess spatial awareness, orientation, and also hand-eye coordination. So some exercises with a joystick. So that was the first two stages. And then from there, there were about 400 people that got through to the psychological testing round at the European Astronaut Center in Cologne. And that was a day of testing. There were some questionnaires. There were interviews one-on-one and in a panel with psychologists. There were also exercises. There was a pair work exercise to kind of test your communication skills. And there was a teamwork exercise or a series of teamwork exercises to see, again, how you work in a team and what kind of roles you might take in a team. And they do more than one. So I guess that means that they can see whether you are able to take on different roles in a team, for example. Then from there, they took 100 people through to the medical selections, which was a full week of medical testing. They did many, many different things. I mean, I'd had some medical testing for Concordia, but that only took one day. And I thought that was a lot at the time, but no, this was a whole week. One of the most exhaustive things they did was on the eyes. And it's not that you have to have 20/20 vision. Your eyes do have to be correctable to 20/20, but that means that you can wear glasses. But they're really looking for healthy eyes and in general, a healthy person so that they're not risking all this investment that they're going to put into you to find that you're not going to be healthy down the line. So that's what that stage was all about. And then from there, they took about 50 people through to a panel interview. There was an exercise there as well, but mainly this was any old panel interview that you might do for a job, but it was tough. They really played their roles well, those are the people on the panel, because every time that they thought that you were in your comfort zone and talking about something that you enjoyed, they'd take you right out of it and get you to speak about something completely different. And it was really broad ranging. So yes, hypothetical situations that you might encounter on the International Space Station, but also questions that you might have from politicians or journalists or children, and then questions about the European Space Agency and what you like, what you don't like, that kind of thing. And then finally, about 25 people went through to the final interview with the Director General of the European Space Agency. And he basically just wanted a chat to get to know you so that he could make his final decision for the 17 of us that were selected. And so that was made up of 5 career astronauts. That means people who leave their job to then go and work for the European Space Agency as astronauts. They've already completed their basic training, and the rest of us make up part of the reserve. So we're waiting for more slots to become available potentially in that astronaut corps, or we're waiting to be called upon for special projects. So our only obligation is that we keep up our medical. So we have an annual medical. And then we have some degree of meetings and familiarizations that we do every year. And ESA can call upon us to do sort of outreach activities. But really, we keep on with our day job, and we have a consultancy contract with ESA.
Was there a particular phase that you found most difficult? I know you said that the medical seemed there was a lot and it was a week long. But was there one which you felt harder than the others?
Yeah, I guess the medical was worrying, but it wasn't the worst stage, because you know, if they find something, well, there's nothing you can do about it. It's kind of a consolation prize to know that there's something wrong that you can work on fixing. But I found probably that the computer-based testing stage to be a little bit scary, because I didn't know in some ways I knew what to expect, because they did send us some practice problems a couple of weeks before, but they were difficult. For example, there was this memory test where they would just read out digits between 1 and 9. They'd just keep reading them out. At some point, they stop. You don't know what point that's going to be. And then you have to type those numbers in backwards, remembering as many of them as you can.
Wow.
The first digit on which you make a mistake, that's how many points you get. So you could get, 10 numbers correct, but if you get the third one wrong, then you only get 2 points. There were some tough ones in that computer-based testing. But I think looking back, the hardest part, the part where I never thought I was going to get through the next stage, but I think the part where I really thought that, okay, that was it, was after the panel interview, just because it was really, I don't know, they kept drawing things out. they felt it was their mission to kind of destabilize us. And these are people, some of them that we'd kind of gotten to know during the selections process, and they became a different person during this interview process and really drilling down into us.
Were there particular skills that you had which you felt worked in your favor? The reason I ask this is I get this perception, speaking to others that aren't involved with astronauts and the process and all of that type of thing, that during astronaut selection, they really look out for those that have pilot experience, that can fly plane or helicopter, that type of thing. Obviously, if you look at the people that got selected, they have a wide range of skills. All of them incredibly impressive, but they have a very wide range of skills. Are there particular skills that you had which you think actually, you know, really worked in your favor? For example, I know you speak many languages, for example. Skills like that, are they really looking out for?
Yeah, I mean, back in the day, the Apollo era, Mercury era, they only selected test pilots. So you absolutely had to be someone who flies planes and have a kind of personality that goes along with that. But it's changed over the years. The rockets tend to fly themselves more or less. And so we end up with half pilots, half scientists and doctors arrangement. I don't think it's particular skills that they're looking out for. I'm sure there are some, but it's more that they're looking for well-rounded people, people who have had a lot of experiences and demonstrated that they can thrive in many different environments and have a sort of cultural awareness that they can work in teams with people from different countries. And so I think it's probably more the human side of things that they're looking for rather than specific hard skills that you've picked up. They want them, but I think it's really the kind of softer skills that they drill down and find in the end.
That kind of nicely ties into what I was going to ask next, which was, if you were speaking to someone that wanted to be an astronaut, let's say they're a teenager and they've got, you know, years ahead to really develop before they actually go through the selection process, what would your recommendation be for that teenager? What skills do you think they should develop before they apply?
It goes back to being that kind of well-rounded person. And the best way of doing that is to follow what you enjoy doing, because we come from so many different backgrounds. It's not like you must do aerospace engineering or astronomy or something related to space. You don't have to become an astronaut, but you do have to be at or near the top of your game at what you are doing. So that means doing something that you actually enjoy. This has the bonus of that, you know, there are only so many places for astronauts. You do also have to be pretty lucky to be selected. So if you're not lucky enough to be selected, then you're already doing something that you love. And if you are selected, then it's a bonus. So that's the most important thing to remember. But the things that you can do to build up your experience, those things that are on the questionnaire. So learning new languages, doing an extra master's degree or something like that, getting some expedition experience, learning to fly if that's what you want to do, learning to dive if that's what you want to do, spend time in a lab or, like I said, in an extreme environment, but that doesn't have to be Antarctica, it could be in a jungle. And they really value if you've done that in a small team for a long period of time. So the key is to look out for opportunities and make sure you're willing to grab them when they come.
And some of those opportunities to be hard. So it sounded like your Antarctica experience, you know, was hard. You know, there's a number of different factors that play to that being difficult, but it was you overcoming that, which was one of the key things that helped develop those skills, which were looked for by the selection process.
Yeah, of course, it doesn't guarantee that you'll be selected, because a lot of my friends who spent a year in Concordia also applied and they didn't get through, but it certainly helps. At the same time, if it's not something that you're going to enjoy, don't do it, because you're probably not going to be good at it. You're going to waste a year of your life, and it's only going to show, like, reflect poorly on you if it's not something that if it's just something that you do to get it done and get it out of the way. No, they want to see also your enthusiasm for the things that you've done.
So as a reserve, what are you doing right now? Because obviously you're waiting for, you said, some projects or a space opening up in the core team. What's happening right now and how do you see the future going?
Yeah, it's a really strange position to be in because there are no guarantees for me. I mean, I know that there are some things in the works, something might be on the horizon, but again, no guarantees. So I'm just kind of waiting and try to make the most of what I'm doing in the meantime. So I wanted to get more into the space sector. I've got a job at the UK Space Agency in the exploration team, and I'm working on future space stations. So after 2030, the International Space Station is going to be decommissioned. It's already outlived its original lifetime. So just eventually it will have to be retired. And after that, there are going to be commercial space stations. So I'm working on what the UK's role in that might be, how we can contribute to the stations, how we can benefit from the stations, and what kind of partnerships we can build. That's whether nationally or through the European Space Agency as well.
I know on email you said you were going to speak to John Kennett regarding about Hi-Fi and the countermeasure that he's developed for using as part of equipment in one of either the International Space Station or the new one, that'd be great, or the Gateway, for example. Have you met up with him yet and had a go?
Yes, I have. Yeah, so this was a lot of fun, actually. So I'm commercial exploration lead as well as reserve astronaut at the UK Space Agency. And so commercial exploration includes things that are being developed by academics and industry to go on, for example, future space stations. And so John's project fits perfectly into that. And just to give a bit of background, which your listeners probably know very well already, but astronauts on the International Space Station have to spend sort of 90 minutes to 2 hours per day, 6 days per week, exercising in order to counteract the effects of things like loss of bone density, loss of muscle mass. It also counteracts problems that might arise like diabetes and kidney stones and that sort of thing. So John and his team are working on this exercise device that it does that a lot more efficiently and effectively. So you wouldn't have to spend nearly so much time exercising. And it also doesn't have the kind of power requirements. It's smaller. And that's especially important for something like Gateway, which is the orbital station that will be built around the moon. And it's a lot smaller. And so we need to have an exercise device that can do a lot of different things in a small amount of space. Mm-hmm. So just a week or two ago, I got to go and visit John and try out his exercise machine. And I can see myself using it on a station one day.
Oh, that's great to hear. It's a very, very cool piece of kit. And you can really just see how functional it would be in that kind of tight situation and how well-rounded the exercises that you can use using it, because obviously you don't just can't just train the legs. The bone density is required throughout the body, and you know, to anything to avoid muscle atrophy, all of those types of things. So yeah, fingers crossed the project pays off.
Yeah, so I'm trying to do what I can to help him out.
That's incredible. You're making me realize that I really should have applied. I don't think I would have got through the stages at all, but just to see how far I could have got and challenged myself, because certainly working with John with the Hi-Fi project, it makes you just how incredible this industry is. And just to dip my toe in it a little bit by applying would have been great fun. But anyone in a similar situation to me, what recommendations would you have for them to get involved in projects like the UK Space Agency might have, or they might be looking out for future recruitment drives? Because I know that the one which you went through was the first one in 12 years, am I right?
Yeah.
And I heard rumors that the next one wasn't going to be as long away, but you never know. So where can people find this information that wants to get involved with projects regarding space travel, etc.?
Yeah, well, there are a lot of different ways. So the plan is that there will be more frequent astronaut selections. We don't know. It could be in 6 years, something like that. Hopefully won't be 12, 13 years like it was last time. Having said that, the age limit they put this time was 55. So it's not like you have no opportunity to do it again. But yeah, so in the meantime, there are a lot of different ways of being involved. You can look out, depending on kind of what stage you're at in your career, you could potentially look out for internships at the European Space Agency. They also do various kinds of postdoctoral fellowships for academics. They have many different types of technical roles as well. And from the UK Space Agency perspective, we often put out calls for proposals for people to do all kinds of things that will benefit many different areas of space, and some of those are exploration. So recently, through our International Bilateral Fund, we've put out a challenge prize. And this is for people to come up with ways of purifying the water that's trapped in the regolith, the lunar dust on the moon. And so they've got to come up with a kind of prototype system for how to purify that water. This is called the Aqualuna Challenge, and it's ongoing. We've got our 10 finalists at the moment. There's also a Canadian track going on at the same time. And so I've been involved as a judge of that, which has been really a lot of fun to see those innovations. But they're the kinds of things that you can be involved in, and you don't have to be with a university or even with a company. You can apply as an individual. So looking out for things like that is a great way of being involved too.
No, that's brilliant. If you have any links, send them my way, because I'll put them in the show notes so anyone can access them, all those types of projects. Megan, that was absolutely incredible. Can I just finish the episode with asking, what would be your dream situation in terms of the project you were asked to do? You moved to the astronaut core team, maybe. What would be like the dream?
Yeah, so many things I would like to do. And I would love to go to the International Space Station, because I've learned so much about the research that goes on there and the kinds of materials and pharmaceuticals and so on that you can manufacture in space that you just can't get on Earth, and the benefits that can bring back to humanity here on Earth. But from a sort of personal, selfish perspective, I would love to stand on the moon and look back on Earth and have that view of Earth like the view that we have of the moon. Because I think that would be breathtaking.
Mm. Yeah, I really hope that you achieve that, especially with the gateway being developed. It feels that type of thing could happen more often, and I really hope it works out for you.
Yeah, I'm hoping so. We are in a moment of sort of increased commercial opportunities in space with these commercial space stations, and also with the Artemis missions going back to the moon and the various companies that are sending rovers to the moon too. So we are in a moment where space is really building. So that's an exciting time to be a part of it.
Yeah, certainly. The space race is not USA, Russia anymore. It's the private companies.
It is. I mean, there's still a geopolitical side to things. China's doing really, really well in their space exploration. And so that has kind of, you know, kicked off a different kind of geopolitical space race as well. But, you know, what I would like to see on the moon, for example, would be a kind of similar situation to what we have in Antarctica based on the Antarctic Treaty. It is a brilliant example of peaceful international cooperation, and everything is based on helping each other out. So it's all on a barter system, for example. You know, you send some supplies this way and we'll help you out with a flight going that way. It's all very interactive and cooperative. So I'd love to see that kind of situation happening on the moon as well.
Yeah, certainly. Brilliant. Megan, that was brilliant. What are your social details for social media? If anyone wanted to maybe contact you because they had a question, for example, where can they find your content?
Yeah, so you can add me on LinkedIn, Megan Christian, or you can find me on the various social platforms. I'm not on TikTok, but I'm on most of the others. You can find me Astro Megan, A-S-T-R-O, sometimes with an underscore, sometimes not, M-E-G-A-N-N-E.
Brilliant. Yeah, we'll put all that in the show notes. But Megan, thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thanks for chatting.
Before we wrap up, I want to give a shout out and my thanks to my production partner, Cult Media. If you are thinking of launching a podcast or want to grow your audience, head to www.cult.media, that's cult with a K, to get started today.